Shoes. Recorded live.
Hi, welcome to Masonic Central, your podcast for Freemasons by Freemasons. Today is March 8th, 2009. This is Greg Stewart and my partner,
Dean Kennedy.
And welcome to our program. We've been off for a few weeks, and we've had a few things changing that we'll talk about a little bit at the end of the show today, and hopefully everybody who out there has found them. But there's certainly some great and exciting things on that front. But this week, I think we have some fun things to do, don't you think, Dean?
Fun? Everything's always fun around here, Greg.
Just checking, making sure you're on your toes. This week, we have a fantastic author on the show, someone that I've followed since my early days coming into Freemasonry, and was a great influence on a lot of the way that I thought about Freemasonry and really took in all that I've learned. This week, we're being joined by Kirk McNulty, who is the author and brother of several books, including Symbol, Secrets, Significance, A Journey Through Ritual and Symbol, The Way of the Craftsman, and I believe other books and other things on the coming front. Have you ever had a chance to read those books, Dean?
Can't say I have, Greg. Thanks for putting me on the spot again. God love you.
I know. Without further ado, let me just say welcome to the program, Kirk. Thanks for joining us tonight.
It's a pleasure to be here, and an honor, too.
We'd certainly appreciate it. We would like to start the show, and perhaps it would be good to tell us a little bit of who Kirk McNulty is.
Well, I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area in the 40s and 50s, attended Stanford University, was an infantry officer in the United States Marine Corps, did my required time, and after I got out of the Corps, I became a computer geek. That's pretty much my background, except for the fact that I'm a Freemason, too.
A computer geek. Now, when was that? That was, I guess, the appropriate question. When did you receive the degrees?
I received the degrees in 61. Well, in 60 and 61. And it was the mid-60s. About 65 when I became a computer geek. The first computer I worked on was a vacuum tube computer that read punched cards.
Wow. That's so you've probably seen a lot of changes with them then as time's gone by.
Well, I worked
a lot of development.
I worked with them right the way through until micros began to appear, and I worked on micros for a little while. But since all the programs were then written you didn't hire somebody to write a special program for you. You went out and bought an accounting software that was already written. So that's when I got out of the geek business.
So, and more specific to Freemasonry, do you belong to any rites, bodies, or side orgs?
Yeah, I belong to the Scottish Rite, 32nd Degree, the Royal Arch, the Shrine, the Red Cross of Constantine, and also to Quattor Coronati Lodge, which is not really a side body, but it has a very specialized dimension to it.
It seems that that's been quite the organization these days with the first American Grand Master and Brent Morris recently.
Yeah, he was good.
Do you get back to many of the meetings there? Do you actually participate with them?
I'm sorry to say I don't. I am an English Mason. I lived in England for 17 years. But I don't get back as frequently as I'd like to these days.
I can imagine. It's probably an extensive trip to make to go to lodge meetings.
Yeah. What I try to do is schedule other meetings to include the time when my lodge opens.
Very good. And this is a question I like to pose to many of our guests, and just to sort of get a picture of activity. But with so many side bodies, do you find that you spend a lot of time in those other bodies, or is most of your time spent in Blue Lodge?
I'm sorry to say that I don't spend very much time at all in the side bodies. I'm mostly in the craft lodges, the Blue Lodge. I think the craft degrees cover the entire scope of Freemasonry. I think the other degrees provide detailed information about various dimensions that in the craft story.
That seems to be a pretty common theme. I know those that are extremely dedicated to whichever body it is, that seems to be where the preponderance of their time takes place.
Yeah.
But in your time with this, you've managed to write some very impressive books. The books is specifically Freemasonry, Symbols, Secrets, and Significance, which is an introduction to the ideas of the fraternity. But your other books, Freemasonry, A Journey Through Ritual and Symbol, and The Way of the Craftsman, seem to have more of a mystical orientation. I guess my first question is how in that time did you manage to put these books together? And I'm curious if there's any reoccurring theme in them.
Well, I managed to put the books together because I have written them since I stopped being a computer geek.
How long ago was that, Kirk?
That would have been...
last week?
No. Pardon?
Last week?
That would have been something week. Like 84. 1984
or 85,
something like that. The books have a mystical orientation because that's my world view of the world. And that's my opinion of what the craft says and does. I mean, I think that's what Freemasonry is.
And I definitely want to get into that, and maybe we can explore a little bit of the different books just to get a little bit of an idea of it. I know in our earlier conversations in talking about the first book, Symbols, Secrets, and Significance, that it was more of an introduction to the ideas of the fraternity.
Mm-hmm.
At the time that you wrote it, did you feel that was something that was missing or that was
As a matter of fact... When I wrote Symbols, Secrets, and Significance in connection with the publisher. It's an art book, as you know, and it was written as a supplement or as a response to the book that Dan Brown is incubating. I understand it's going to be published reasonably soon. It was supposed to happen in 07, about Washington, D.C., and a substantial amount of Freemasonry in there. And this book was published with the idea that the material about Freemasonry, that Symbols, Secrets, Significance presents, would be a general introduction to anybody who was interested in the craft by virtue of what Dan Brown said.
It's almost a companion piece to the work that he has coming in, a point of reference.
Yes, I think so.
Interesting. Interesting. Have you had much feedback from it? Have you heard from many of those that have read it that have...
My understanding is that it is being pretty well enjoyed. It's been translated into 13 languages other than English.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I have a shelf here with copies from each language. I can't read them, some of them.
I can't even
identify the title on the cover, but it's there.
How does an author, when they get their work translated, how do they know that it's all kept in proper context?
I'm going to leave this to the publisher. The publisher of that book is Kemp Hudson, who is a very, very serious publisher in London, and they do a very, very good job. So I'm content with them.
and it's been out since 06, so it doesn't necessarily go back very far. It's a fairly recent book.
I think it's 07, yeah, but that's okay. Maybe it is 06, I don't know. I've forgotten. I'm not standing next to the bookcase right now, so I can't tell you exactly, but
sure.
It is a recent book.
A recent one. And the other one, that one of my favorites, and it's a diminutive book. It's not very thick, but it speaks volumes. A Journey Through Ritual and Symbol.
Yes, that also is an art book, but that comes in a series which Thames and Hudson does called the Art and Imagination series, and it deals with mystical orientation, all kinds of subjects.
In reading it, it almost had the feeling of reading a Wilmhurst lecture from the past. I could almost see this as something delivered in a lodge. Was that the idea in putting it together? Is this was a presentation at some point that became a book?
No,
or?
It was. No, that was not the presentation. It's very kind of you to say it was a Wilmhurst lecture. Sounded like a Wilmhurst lecture because I am a serious admirer of Wilmhurst, but I just put it together to present Freemasonry from this context as best I could.
It's a great book. I know it's whenever I need anything answered, I can go back to it and mine information right out of it. And
thank you very much.
Several different lodge libraries that I've looked at, it's been on the shelf, and it's one of those frequently dog-eared books that you could tell many have spent a lot of time with.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at my copy right now with highlights across it. And The Way of the Craftsman, tell us a little bit about that one.
Well, that's the first book I wrote. And I wrote it shortly after I stopped being in the computer business. And it reflected my experience and understanding of Freemasonry. And I thought that that ought to be, I don't know, I just thought that that would be a useful dimension to get out there, because back in the 1980s, when that was published, the mystical interpretation of Freemasonry was not as universal as it is now. Well, it's not universal now, but not as general as it is now. And I thought it might be useful to the for the craft to have that dimension available.
Kirk, there's actually a question in the gallery coming out. There was the people actually looking around for The Way of the Craft and the Craftsman. And is that out of print now, or?
No, it is in print, but it's not. It's not generally available. The place where you can buy it it's not that it's not available, but it's not passed around much. The place where you can buy it is right to the bookstore in the George Washington Masonic National Memorial in Alexandria, Virginia. They stock it.
Oh, excellent.
And they can sell it. If you get a hold of them, they'll give you the information about how to get it.
That's great, because it is one of those books that on Amazon actually don't show it as in stock anymore, sadly.
But it's published. It's being published, but that's how you get it in this country.
A shorter distribution for it, sounds like.
Yeah.
That's definitely something to look for. So just as you said a moment ago, at the point that you had written that book with the idea of perhaps reintroducing mysticism to the fraternity at that time, as you said, it wasn't very prevalent then, nor as it is now. Did you find that there was an open receptivity to it then when bringing it up in that context and putting it into a book?
Well, when it was... when it was first published, it was published as a regular book, and that didn't last very long. But it they narrowed it down and put it out into specific areas. But you can buy it in England in bookstores, and you can buy it in at the Grand Lodge of England and that sort of thing. And in regalia shops, it's probably not the most popular dimension yet, but I think it's growing. I get the feeling that more and more people, especially younger ones, are interested in this whole dimension of life.
And that's, again, the reference to Wilmhurst. It just seems that it's, at one point in time in the past, it seemed extremely prevalent, and it sort of dropped off, at least in the last century.
Well, if you think about the Wilmshurst period, there was a real interest, generally speaking, in mystical activities about 100 years ago, at the turn of the last century, from the late 1800s and early 1900s. I think that's probably the Wilmshurst period. And then that got less popular. But somehow now more and more people are interested in this dimension of life.
I'm curious your thoughts. How do you think the Freemasonry picked up these ideas of mysticism, and perhaps even, as you get into the Scottish Rite, the Kabbalah and all? How do you think these ideas came about?
Well, let me push us back to the origins of Freemasonry, which are among the most difficult and debated subjects in the whole world, all business of history, historical research. But I would refer you to the works of Frances Amelia Yeats. She was a reader of history. The term reader in this case is an English academic rank equivalent to what we would call associate professor. She was a reader of history at the University of London, and her field was the history of thought. And she was so well respected that she finally became a dame of the British Empire. Now, her various works make the point that the philosophical essence of the Renaissance was the Hermetic Kabbalistic tradition. And to avoid a long digression into that, very, very simply, it said if you followed your faith, any of your faith, and not any particular religion, in an interior way, and did it carefully and diligently, you could experience the divine presence while you were still incarnate here. And I think that's what Freemasonry does. As I think Freemasonry is a codification. Freemasonry starts at the end of the Renaissance, and I think Freemasonry is a codification of this philosophical essence of the Renaissance.
Hey, this might be going out a little bit on a limb, but how do you think that essence moved into Freemasonry from what we know as craft guilds at the time into a philosophical society like that?
Well, in the 1600s, the first evidence we see of speculative masonry, as opposed to the craft guilds of operative masons, are what we call casual lodges, because there was no grand lodge to make formal lodges. Casual lodges meeting in pubs in Britain in the late 1600s. That's the end of the Renaissance. I think these guys were looking to preserve the philosophy of the Renaissance, because in the late 1600s, the Royal Society had just been started, and there was an interest in scientific investigation. Not science, because we know it quite yet. That didn't happen until the 1800s. But scientific investigation rather than the philosophical studies of the Renaissance, and I think these guys who are meeting in casual lodges were seeking to preserve this Renaissance philosophy, and I think they put. Well, I think they chose Masonry as the place to go, because the in those days the intellectual requirement that you had to have to build cathedrals and build castles and so forth made Masonry the center of educational process in the Renaissance. And I think they were attracted to Masonry because of that, these intellectually inclined men. And I think they pulled it together that way.
It almost begs the question of which came first, the scientific revolution or the interest in it. which one perpetuated the other.
Well, I think the philosophical ideas which I was talking about early started at around 1350, when the guys who started the Renaissance in Florence actually named it. They were looking, it means rebirth, and they were looking for a rebirth of the classical philosophies. And that's where the Hermetic Kabbalistic tradition came from.
This may be going on a limb a little bit. I'm curious your thoughts to the period that led up to that Renaissance, that change, that rebirthing. The ideas that they brought forward, do you think that Masonry itself codified many of those earlier existing ideas, or do you think that it's become a hybrid of those ideas as they were seen at that era?
I think they took the Hermetic Kabbalistic ideas, particularly probably the Kabbalistic model, and codified it in order to preserve it and to teach it in a manner which was not offensive to the church, because the church was easily offended in the 1600s. I mean, if you did things they didn't like, they tried to burn you.
Burned you at stake.
We even burned one in Boston. So you got to be careful about that. And it wouldn't surprise me if they codified it as they did in order to be not... this can happen. I mean, the Masonic work can happen in the context of any religion, as of course, you know. So
to be put a little bit more sub rosa and not so much necessarily in the face as much
yes.
as just kind of generally speaking.
Right.
And a general take of it. Any thoughts as to how the craft guilds took to it? I mean, obviously, we have the fraternity as exists today. We're not the woolsmiths or the winemakers guild. How do you think that they took to it? Do you think that they absorbed it and ran with it? Or do you think over time the progression changed, obviously from the operative to the speculative, keeping these ideas?
I think the speculative people probably borrowed the operatives were interested in the disciplines of building, but they were also interested in the seven liberal arts and sciences, because you needed all of them to design and build the structures of the Renaissance. And I think that was the thing that attracted the philosophically inclined people to the Masons guilds. But I think, this is a personal notion. There's no Grand Lodge that supports or validates this idea. You're just getting my prejudices. But I suspect that the people who were meeting in the casual lodges were looking for some idiom that they could use Masonic symbolism with. And they hunted around, and they found a quote in the Bible that said, "Know ye not that ye are the temple?" And then they chose the Temple of Solomon as a model of the individual, of the candidate, if you want, as he went through degrees.
They found a reference point to
yeah.
it.
Yeah, that's my take.
I know in certain some books that I've picked up and had a chance to read, and not some of the more astute historians to it, but the more speculative in the sense, but Hall associating it with some of the early mystery plays that were done early on, and that how it the two came together. Any thoughts to that? Do you think that it,
plays? What mystery plays are you thinking of?
The mystery plays of the craft guilds, the craft guilds that would put on various plays within the towns.
It's not an area with which I'm familiar. I really can't comment at all on that. I'm sorry,
Oh, no worries, no worries at all. I know the Hall in the sense of what I've read. It's not necessarily it's never given as true history. It's always the speculative end of it. and some of what he has to say is that just as the builders would put on these different plays, that the Solomon's Temple as one of the plays that might have been put on as they reinterpreted the Bible would have fit beautifully with the system of teaching. And I wonder how much of that I picked up through it. You did mention Yeats, though, and a lot of what Yeats said, she seems to bring together a lot of these different groups, including the Rosicrucian Enlightenment and these ideas that built up in Middle Europe. Do you think that those influenced Freemasonry at all in the early centuries of the Renaissance?
Well, I think the thinking... perhaps not the groups themselves, but the thinking which came out of the groups, I think, was very influential with the brethren who started the thing. Yeah.
I know we often like to try to draw these parallels back to these older traditions. Any thoughts to the older traditions, the Knight Templars and I guess Gnosticism? Any ideas to that as that
well,
came forward into?
The Gnostics are pretty much earlier than that. Although they had a dimension that was similar to the philosophical essence of the Renaissance that Yeats talks about, the Knights Templar are. I don't think they are a foundation of Freemasonry. I think they are. They may very well have had a mystical orientation of their own, but I don't think they are a foundation of Freemasonry. I think Freemasonry is more British in its origins.
I like your answer for that. We, in different discussions that we've had with other authors, it seems that we've come to the same consensus on that. And Templarism and Freemasonry oftentimes enjoying the parallels between ideas, but not so much necessarily direct lineage to it. I'm curious now, even with all of this in your research to it, tell us how you came about to see this this idea of mysticism and fraternity. How is it that you initially came to see these ideas?
Well, this is a this is a personal notion. I was raised I received the degrees in 1960-61 in Carson Valley Lodge number 33 in Gardnerville, Nevada. At that time, I was still in the Marine Corps, teaching military rock climbing and military skiing at the Cold Weather Training Center at Pickle Meadows, California. And then I got sent to Hawaii, where I met Brother Joel Goldsmith, who was speaking in a lodge. As we were talking after the lodge, I lit up a cigarette. I had been smoking 3 packs a day for about 11 years. And Joel said to me, one of these days you won't want to do that. And I said, I'm sure you're right. I tried to quit hundreds of times. One of these days I'll make it. 3 days later, I lit up what must have been the 63rd cigarette of the day. It seemed the most foolish thing that I ever did. I mashed it out, and I have never wanted to smoke since. I called Joel to tell him about this, and I found out that he was a spiritual teacher and a healer. And so I studied with him for 2.5 years. There were actually several Masonic brethren who were among Joel's students, and we spent about an evening a week discussing the mystical dimensions of the craft. Then I got sent to Okinawa. That's my introduction to mystical tradition.
How did you find Joel's teaching? How did you find it relating to the fraternity? Any particular points in it that seemed to resonate with the work that you received in Lodge to some of his philosophies?
Not so much from the Lodge rituals itself. Very simply, Joel taught meditation. Go inside, meditate, and seek to experience the divine presence within you. And that seems to have been the purpose of the Kabbalistic tradition, the Hermetic Kabbalistic tradition in the Renaissance, and the source of the craft. So I didn't find Joel's teachings relating specifically to the craft, but the fundamental purposes were the same.
The idea of building the inner temple.
If you like.
It seems to be a...
Although I suspect, to be perfectly honest, that the temple is already there. What we are doing is exploring it.
Rediscovering, yeah. I would agree. I would agree with that, actually.
Actually, there's a lot of junk in the passages of the temple, and what we're doing is clearing the junk out so we can walk around inside the temple and learn.
Now, you had said earlier in the conversation here about the younger generation starting to key into some of these ideas. I'm curious, do you see much of this sort of interior work or interior cleaning being picked up on much by the fraternity? Do you read a lot of material that talks to this or hear a lot of chatter about that?
Not a lot, but generally speaking, well, there are three kinds of lodges. There are lodges with three emphases. Consider our basic principles, brotherly love, relief, and truth. Many lodges, perhaps most, meet for the sake of companionship and good fellowship and fun, and that's brotherly love. Relief describes our charitable activities, which are really very significant. And truth describes the philosophical search, which I find practiced in a few lodges. In the D.C. area, I'm surprised to find that there are, I think, several. I can't number them right offhand, but several that have a philosophical orientation. And I get invited to talk to lodges with my philosophical prejudices pretty regularly.
That must be a good barometer to judge if the ideas are being picked up, just the fact that they want you to come out and talk about it.
Yeah, well, this is particularly interesting among younger, like I said, people like people under 30, I would say, are really the most interested in this kind of thing.
Is it is this much different than what you saw initially back when you first started exploring these ideas with the books? You said that the climate was different then when you wrote the first book on the topic. Is there a noticeable difference between then and now?
Well, yeah, a little bit, but I have to say that my personal experience is only my personal experience, and it's so limited that it's probably not statistically feasible, if you see what I mean.
Sure.
Not feasible, statistically significant. I do think, generally speaking, that there is probably a greater interest now in the mystical or metaphysical dimension than there used to be.
Greg, I think he's onto something there, and I don't know how, you know, Masonry as a whole would go about. I mean, we've been so far away from that for so long. I don't know how we would turn the ship around, so to speak. But definitely, I think that there is a growing interest in that in this sort of thing. And
there are people all over the United States that have this kind of interest. Brethren all over the United States.
Yeah, and I can say in Canada, too, there are some as well. Yeah.
That leads me to the question, though, and this is just purely on your speculation, but do you think that building on those ideas is important or valuable? You know, the exploration of the internal journey with the allegories of Freemasonry, do you think that that's probably a silly question, but a worthwhile endeavor?
It depends on the attitude of the master of the lodge. If he wants to do it, I think it is worthwhile. Let me say again that these are my ideas, not the policy or teachings of any grand lodge. But it seems to me that that's an important thing to do. I think that, as a matter of fact, I think it's a real opportunity for Freemasonry these days because of the perception I have, not necessarily Masonically, but perception I have of the emerging 20-some-year-olds and how they have this interest. And that's the group of people to whom we ought to make ourselves attractive. We shouldn't make ourselves attractive by changing anything we do, but because changing us is important not to, but perhaps interpreting what we do differently might be valuable, especially if it attracts people from this generation.
Yeah, I think what you're dealing with there, Kirk, and I can hear it in your voice, is trying to establish what change means, and maybe change doesn't mean changing our total modus operandi, but refocusing on certain things that we've been doing or maybe we're doing but don't do anymore.
The way you interpret the symbolic structure.
I just think that whenever you say the word change in our organization, there's a big shock factor, and everyone draws their own version of what change means, and obviously our organization resists change to some degree. But
To some extent, it should.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the changes which occurred in Europe in the mid to late 1700s, when they introduced a brand of Freemasonry that didn't require a belief in the deity, as one example. That's big change. And you can't practice the kind of Freemasonry that I've been speaking of this evening if people don't believe in a deity.
See, I was actually going to raise that question to it in that context, that inner journey, that cleaning out of the interior temple, ultimately is to connect with the divine presence.
Yes.
How do you think that individuals take that idea? Because I know that flies in the face often of defining what deity means and how one interacts with it, and certainly going into that metaphysical dimension that you described, it requires this sort of aspect of religion without being religion, but of faith to go in exploration of. And I'm curious your thoughts to that.
I think each religion has this dimension. And my understanding of the craft is that each brother, if he wants to follow this, follows this dimension in his own faith, in his own religious context. The teachings of the craft only set out the basic principles. For a very simple summary, using Solomon's Temple as a model, the ground floor, the first degree, represents the interface with the physical world. And the teachings are about acting with discipline and integrity using tools of action. The middle chamber represents the soul, the seat of one's morality, and the tools are tools of testing. Each tests against an absolute criterion. And the Holy of Holies is the place where the deity resides. The kingdom of God is within you, as the book says. And when you get there, in the journey in consciousness within the temple that you are, you experience the divine presence. Now, I say it that way because you can't. I strive not to assign any attributes to deity at all, because ascribing an attribute to deity places a limitation on it. I just open myself and do the best I can to experience it. I haven't experienced it yet, but I'm confident that it's possible.
And I think that's where we start to embark into where some of the less liked areas of Masonry go as we start to talk about that divine relationship. And I'm curious if you've ever had any thoughts to or heard anything in regards to the establishing of that train of thought, because it really is a different approach that you have to take to the degrees, rather than on a superficial or on a surface level, and really dig down into them to embrace it and see beyond the ritual necessarily and grasp what's going on with that. Have you ever had any thoughts to that or run into that in the past?
Well, I've tried to express that somewhat in my two books, which have this. But in fact, I think if you work on the ground floor and you practice the disciplines that are envisioned for the entered apprentice, eventually what happens is that you achieve what the Jungian psychologist would call the individuation of the self. And that's a prerequisite before you start the interior journey. And then the climbing of the stairs and going to the middle chamber is an adventure which the self undertakes. That's the sort of thing that... does that make any sense?
It does.
The kind of thing you're asking?
It does. It does. It is one of those questions that's sort of vague and asks for a degree of speculation as to opinion on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I am curious, as we continue along here in the 21st century, how that aspect of it will be looked at, if it'll fall to a specific idea of the ritual for the ritual, or the ritual as something else. An idea that I've frequently fallen back to is that as we look at the aspects of the degrees themselves as symbolic, that you would have to look at the whole thing as symbolic. You know, how do you take just part of it as one thing and then treat the whole thing as something else? That in fact the whole thing is just representative of another process.
Well, I think if you look at the idea of Sali's temple from the perspective that you are the temple, then it's symbolic of you. And the ground floor is your ordinary consciousness, and the middle chamber is your soul. And the Holy of Holies is where you can experience the divine presence.
Where you connect with it. And this really goes back to some of what we were talking about just a few minutes ago, the ideas of the Renaissance and of some of the writers then, the Paracelsus and Agrippa's and John Dee's and these aspects of different realms of this metaphysical life, of how we interact with the divine and with Jacob's ladder and the such.
Those writers talked about four worlds. The divinity and the spirit and the I guess they talked about the soul, but I would call it the psyche, and then the physical world. I think the lodge represents the psyche, with the third degree interfacing with the spirit, and the first degree interfacing with the physical world, and the second degree the soul being purely in that part of the world. That would be my way of approaching the various levels which the guys you referred to in the Renaissance.
Mm-hmm. And this is something that others have picked up on too. I've always felt might be my own reading into it, but even in some of the works of Pike and through his degrees and the Wilmhursts, and as they've written these ideas down and explored them, that it seemed that it was always that transcendent idea of moving in between them.
Yes, yes, yes. Pike and Wilmhurst have the idea of transcending the ordinary experience into something quite extraordinary.
And I wonder if just those ideas if they've been a little bit too far out there, you know, if they've been taken just as the whole speculative end of it, you know, if it's just something that hasn't necessarily been taken seriously or just been taken as a grain of philosophy along with the rest of it.
Well, I don't know. I think probably most people don't take them seriously, but some do. And that has to do with the three aspects of brotherly love, relief, and truth, and the lodges which specialize in each one. And that's appropriate. Because no matter which lodge you... If you enter a lodge that's big on brotherly love, and you get a philosophical interest, you can always affiliate with another lodge.
And explore it. Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
The craft offers many opportunities in this respect.
There's actually a question in our gallery that I was just pointed out to, and this is a might dig a little bit deep, but the question is: is there any sort of Masonic historical instances or records of that sort of classic experience, the experience of the light? So perhaps of the metaphysical nature?
Not to my knowledge. No, I don't believe, I don't know of any historical reference to such an experience.
I'm trying to think through my own head. I can't think of anything that's ever been documented as such. You know, I think you could probably read into Wilmshurst and infer that perhaps that's sort of what he was.
I think that's certainly what Wilmshurst is talking about, and I would be surprised if he hadn't experienced it. But that's as much as I can say.
And that experience itself is, for lack of a better word, a little bit alien, I think, to what most traditionalists or of what most religious systems really seem to promote or what they talk about. It seems less the mysticism, even with Christian mysticism, it seems less emphasized today as it may have in the past. And I'm wondering if that might have something to do with it, just that the system itself doesn't lend itself to that sort of dialogue.
Well, certainly the Christian religion does not, these days, emphasize a mystical teaching very much, or at least the part of it that I have experienced. books from the Middle Ages. I'm sorry, I have a couple of them, and I'm sorry to say that the authors don't come to my mind right now, and I'm not sitting in my library. But there are a few authors. When I communicate later, I will with you. I will email you a couple of names. But there are a few writings that have this mystical orientation.
Go ahead.
I was going to say my suspicion is that originally, and I'm talking about the 12th century or something, just after the Council of Nicaea, that the teachings that happened in the monasteries were more mystically inclined, monasteries and convents were more mystically inclined than the general ones in the churches.
A little bit more cloistered, something that would keep the ideas internal rather than down the streets, because even in later centuries, the Christian mystics that came out, I'm trying to think of the names offhand. I didn't make any notes to it, not thinking that we'd talk about it much. But just as the later Renaissance Christian mysticism really started to come to a head, even then it was still something that was pushed down a little bit more by the church itself. That it wasn't.
Yes.
That wasn't picked up very much. And all this does lead me to the idea of the idea of it being a rebirthing of the New Age ideas that we've seen prevalent here in this country in the last maybe 30 years or so, but that really tie back to a further back era, a bygone era. But it's coming back today. I'm curious your thoughts to that. How much do you of this aspect of it, do you think relates to these ideas of what would some would see as New Age today?
Well, New Age is New Age material is curious. New Age stuff is, well, the stuff that was called New Age in the 60s and 70s. It actually a restatement of material that human beings have been studying for thousands of years. And it's relevant because it touches on a subject which is eternally important. How good the New Age idioms are is a question altogether different, and I can't comment on that.
I hear you, and I agree with you, and I think that it's it's that aspect of that internal work that I think that that we can link back to it. You know, there may not be a fast tie, but certainly a commonality to it.
Right. Well,
in a lot of respect.
If you're going to say I'm the temple and I'm going to explore the temple, then that's pretty much the kind of things that New Age folk were seeking.
What they're looking for. I'm curious, and we touched on it earlier, and just to your thoughts, to circle it back into the rest of the dialogue, your ideas of Kabbalah and how that's perhaps manifested into Freemasonry at all or into the other side degrees, do you think that it's been picked up on at all, or is it a lone strand out there in the overall metaphysical exploration?
Well, I don't know. I think Kabbalah in the 1600s and early 1700s, as the Renaissance ended, Kabbalah became in Britain a generic idiom for speaking of the interior worlds. And when you look at the ritual and when you look at the symbolic structure of Freemasonry that was put together in 1813, when they put the United Grand Lodge together in England, the emulation working, and part, well, I'm talking about the symbolic structure of the emulation working. The symbolic structure evolved right the way through the 1700s and got formalized in 1813. And that emulation symbolic structure fits very, very well on the Tree of Life.
And it may be even important to tie it back to what you were saying, I think, at least, that it still resonates with the idea of building that interior temple.
Oh,
the,
yes.
The progressive steps of it.
Yes, without question. Without question. I put the emulation working on the Tree of Life, and it fits very nicely. And the Tree of Life is itself a ladder which one climbs with the purpose of experiencing divine presence. Or at least, Kabbalah is an enormously difficult subject. I studied it for 10.5 years when I was in England. But there are so many different Kabbalistic teachings and idioms, and it's impossible to generalize it.
I think most of us that would have embarked in our limited capacity to try to understand it would agree. I know I've found that to be the case. You know, just when you think you get it.
May I recommend an author to you?
Please.
Ze'ev Ben Shimon Halevi.
Can you repeat that? I need to write that down.
Ze'ev. Z-E-V. Ben,
okay.
Little B. Shimon. S-H-I-M-O-N.
Mm-hmm.
Halevi. H-A-L-I-V-I. E-V-I. Halevi. He's written many books on the subject, and although he had a traditional upbringing, he has related the teachings let me oversimplify it by saying Jungian psychology. That's oversimplification, but he relates it to contemporary understandings, so that it really is immediately applicable.
We're all scribbling down notes here to look them up. Have you found that in your studies of the Kabbalah that it's come back and influenced, or vice versa, Freemasonry as having been influenced by it, or do you think that it all just ties together with that, the whole Renaissance thought of development of the time?
I think it ties together with the original development of Freemasonry. I think there are some Masons today who are interested, but that's always the case.
Right, right. I know I often find that it's difficult to pick and choose or to separate when and where certain aspects sort of cross over into each other, which leads me to believe that at some point it was an overall mashup of this, and that some ideas have percolated through and some haven't, some have fallen out.
Well, it's difficult because the subject of Kabbalah is so broad and you could only take a certain narrow bit of it that found its way into the craft.
Exactly.
Or was used by the craftsmen who put the craft together.
Exactly. I'm this is changing the directions here, but I know we're coming close to our hour. So if anybody in the gallery there has any specific questions, now's your time to key them in or let us know that you have them. But I wanted to ask, outside of the books, are there any places on the web that anybody would be able to find any of your work? That seems to be where we go most often today.
I have not put any material on the web, although I do understand that other people have put some of my stuff up there. The thing that comes to mind as being, when you haven't talked about it, is there's an article on Kabbalah and Freemasonry in Herodom, volume number 7, which might be useful.
Very good. And if I may be so bold, I know we talked about this beforehand, but with our new endeavor in our website, I would like to ask, would you be willing to put together a paper we'd be able to publish?
I will put one together for you, and we need to do a little bit of email communication to sort of define what you want it to look like.
Oh, it's wonderful. You hear that, Dean?
I'm listening.
That's wonderful. And importantly, any works on the horizon? Anything that we should keep an eye out for?
I'm incubating one which has to do with the application of some of the principles we've spoken of this evening to large education programs for use by those worshipful masters that would choose to do this kind of thing. I will promise you that the work will use only unmodified rituals and symbols of the craft. The only new idea will be interpretations of the symbols, but the symbols and rituals will be as they are now. No,
that's interesting.
No changes introduced.
Any timetables when we could keep our eyes off for that, or is that something that's on the far horizon?
No, I've got other things I have to do in order to keep body and soul together, and so I will write that as soon as I can. But I don't have a horizon, I'm sorry to say.
We did have one question, and it was only one that we had come in right at the end here, and that is one of our listeners wants to know if your idea of deity is a conscious deity.
Deity? A conscious?
Yeah, sorry.
I'm
Canadian. I flub up on my pronunciations all the time.
That's quite all right. I'm not sure what conscious deity means. Because of my problem that I don't assign attributes to divinity.
Mm-hmm.
But let me say that I think of divinity or the deity as the source of everything there is. I'm a Neoplatonist. I don't... You know about Neoplatonism?
Greg?
Hello?
Hey, yeah, you have me. We must have just lost Greg there for a second.
Okay.
You can maybe for the listeners, you should just tell us a little bit about what Neoplatonism is then.
Well, let me say this. The creator, I'm sitting in a beautiful house that was created by a wonderful architect, but the architect is separate from the house, and a creator is separate from his creation. I don't think this was intended to be the teaching of Genesis, but that's what it has resulted in. So instead of saying that God created the universe, I think that God willed itself into existence as all that is. That's a statement of Neoplatonism. That's how the kingdom of God comes to be within every one of us. This is not an unusual idea. Saint Augustine of Hippo, who was one of the participants in the Council of Nicaea, was an enthusiastic Neoplatonist. But that, well, I don't know. That says to me that God is the source and essence of everything. I'm trying to answer this question as
I think a conscious deity.
Divinity, kind of aware of everything. I don't understand the nature of a conscious deity. I don't understand the question, really.
Yeah.
But I've expressed all my prejudices.
I think by answering it that way, you're kind of answering the question by saying that you don't understand. So I think you kind of answered by saying you can't answer that.
Well, but Neoplatonism is my approach. Anyway,
Greg, are you back on us now? I guess not. Okay, we did have a little bit of technical problems there while we've been talking about Neoplatonism. We are a little bit over the hour there, Kirk. For people trying to get your books, where would they be able to obtain them?
Well, you can probably order the Thames and Hudson books, the art books, through any bookstore, although you might have to ask the bookstore to order it for you. If you want to get The Way of the Craftsman, write to the George Washington Masonic National Memorial. They will send it to you for sure.
Excellent. And do they have a website? I guess you.
Oh yes, they certainly do. Yeah.
Okay, so people can just look that up on Google or Yahoo or whatever they looked for. And
I don't know whether they put the books on Google or Yahoo or that kind of stuff, but they can certainly Google the George Washington Masonic National Memorial and get to their website.
Okay, Kirk, I'm just going to say a few things to end the show, and maybe if you could just hang out for 1 second, for a few minutes, and some people might have some questions for you in the audience afterwards, after the show, if you don't mind.
I'll hang in there for a minute.
Okay. So just to remind everybody, you can access our past programs on our website, MasonicCentral.com, as well as our calendar. And you can also get other goings on with the show. You can also look for us on iTunes and download it to your favorite MP3 player. As everyone is familiar, all our content is representative of the contributors and does not represent the opinions of any regular or irregular Masonic bodies or Grand Masonic Lodge. I'd just like to, one, thank you, Kirk, for coming on tonight, and as well for Greg, who is always helping me out to host this show. He's just not with me right at this particular moment as we're closing the show. And I'd also like to thank everyone listening and contributing to the podcast for being a part of the a part of bringing more light to the Masonic world. We have next week's scheduled event will be, just give me 1 second while I look it up. Next week's show will be it will be Professor Margaret Jacobs, actually, and I'm just going to end it at that. You can send us all email at MasonicCentral@gmail.com, and don't forget to check out our new website. We've now brought all the players into our new website, MasonicInformation.com. I encourage everyone to go and check that out. We'll have a whole show on that coming up in a couple weeks, but you can check out us for forming up right now over at FreemasonInformation.com. Check it out right now. This is Brother Dean saying, see you in the East.